bonjour and bienvenue to Battle Royale, where we are passing judgment on all the kings and emperors of France, from Clovis to Napoleon III!
Who will be selected as the creme de la creme, and who will be sent to the guillotine? I'm just doing your energy.
To a Phil Ben Clark!
Not like the sun! No, I'm joking.
And we're coming in with a hot. We're coming in hot with some energy today.
Yeah, but I don't know how long that will last.
Well, you can say the same for Charles VIII. So, we're talking about Charles VIII today, the son of Louis XI and the brother of Anne of France and the husband of Anne of Brittany, who will also be getting her own episode for reasons that will become clear when we do her episode.
Nice.
But will not be clear yet, not today. Should we dive straight into his life?
Yes, let's.
Have you ever heard of Charles VIII, by the way?
Yes, I have.
Because he was on the Borgias TV show?
Yeah, and also because I read that book and then I had to stop for the past 3 years. It's got my bookmark in it and it's like halfway through and it's been like that for 3 years.
Well, we will be able to assess the accuracy of Charles's appearance in that show.
I also just remember Lucrezia in that show. That actress, I loved her.
Unfortunately, Lucrezia won't feature much at all, I'm afraid. But
I know.
When we do our special episode on Caterina Sforza, Lucrezia might make some more appearances there.
I love that actress though, by Lucrezia. She's so beautiful.
Holiday Granger, she's lovely.
Well, yeah. Her voice, so soothing.
Yeah. Oh, you should see if she's done any audiobooks.
Oh, yeah. I should.
Yeah. So, Charles VIII, he was born on the 30th of June, 1470, to King Louis XI of France and his wife Charlotte of Savoy. And like his sister, Anne of France, he was raised in quiet comfort at the Chateau of Amboise in the Loire Valley. And we've gone into what their childhood was like there. It was kind of removed from court. It was very much a feminine space controlled by the queen, who's very highly educated, big collector of books. Mm-hmm. And various historians have blamed the dominant roles of women on Charles's perceived weakness and his unmanliness.
Of course.
I'd be quicker to blame Charles's physical and mental weaknesses on centuries of royal inbreeding, but, you know, what do I know? I'm not a scientist. Yeah. I'm just a person with common sense. That being said, Charles's personality was a far cry from his father's. Was probably more influenced by his mother. He was more of a sort of romantic. He grew up with dreams of leading France to glory in a crusade.
How's that romance?
Well, it's romantic in like the whole like chivalry kind of sense. The crusades are very much romanticized, with people telling stories about Charlemagne in Spain and Louis IX in the
Holy
Land.
That's rhyming. Charlemagne in Spain.
So Charles, he was perhaps a little naive compared to his father and compared to his sister as well. But he ended up proving a lot better than they might have been at sort of endearing himself to his nobles and his people. He was very social. He was very cheerful. He was very friendly.
Nice.
Which is something we haven't really seen in a king since Charles VI, before he went mad. So Charles had a long list of elder brothers, none of whom managed to survive infancy. And he ended up being born quite late in his father's reign. So he was only 13 when his elderly father, Louis XI, died peacefully in 1483.
Yeah.
So at the time, Charles was at Amboise, his birthplace, under the care of his sister Anne, while his mother was also terminally ill. So they were orphaned just a few months later.
Oh, it's always sad when parents die close together.
And this episode, to prevent confusion with a different Anne, I will call Anne the name that she was called in her time, which was Madame La Grande, the great lady.
Okay.
Yeah, because another Anne's going to come along and make this very confusing. So Anne of France is now Madame La Grande. She's the first lady of the kingdom. And as we saw last episode, La Grande and her husband, Pierre, who will soon succeed as the Duke of Bourbon. They have a struggle with the Duke of Orleans over the regency, including an attempted kidnapping of Charles.
Oh, yes, I remember.
And that culminates in the Mad War, which will also become entangled in an independence war in Brittany. But we got into this struggle, which consumed the rest of the 1480s last episode, We'll be getting into it more in Anne of Brittany's episode as well. So I'm going to leave that kind of to the side for now. But from Charles's perspective...
Put a pin in it.
Yeah. So throughout the conflict, Charles was involved, actually. Like, he wasn't completely sidelined. And throughout the conflict, he was staunchly loyal to his sister, Madame Legrand. Nice. He always stood by her.
I was like that sibling support.
And he refused to give in to the pleading of Orleans, who eventually found himself captured in battle and imprisoned by the royal forces. Mm. Although he was treated very well as a royal cousin. So Charles VIII, he was very well served in Brittany, both by his sister's political manoeuvring and by his skilled generals, some of whom were actually Bretons themselves who had turned to the French side. And part of the reason for this renewed conflict is that the Bretons have a young female heir, Anne of Brittany, and the Holy Roman Emperor's son, Maximilian von Habsburg, is determined to marry Anne in order to bring Brittany into the Habsburg sphere of influence and surround France on all sides, because the Habsburgs are also working on an alliance with Isabel and Ferdinand of Spain as well, who are ruling at this time. After Maximilian tries and fails to invade France in support of Brittany, the French managed to gain control over Brittany and custody over Anne as well.
Yeah.
So Anne of Brittany, as I said, she's getting her own episode, so we'll be getting more into this conflict in further detail later. But for now, we'll just fast forward to 1491, when the French take the city of Rennes, and with it the young Duchess Anne, who signs the Treaty of Rennes and is taken to France, where she is married to King Charles VIII of France, initially in a secret ceremony, because they...
Oh, I love a secret ceremony.
She's technically by this point married by proxy to Maximilian. I don't know if you know what marriage by proxy is.
Yeah, it's when it's like you're not there, but
yeah, there's like a stand-in. Marriages by proxy were a good way to like kind of make the deal before we actually send over the princess, you know, to ensure that everything's like she won't get left at the altar, basically. But you know, Anne and Maximilian never actually end up linking up. And Charles is able to put a stop to that. And Charles, as we mentioned, also had to unbetroth himself to Maximilian's daughter, just to thicken the plot a bit, in order to marry Anne. And he got a papal dispensation to do this. So Charles is fully just severing ties with the Austrian Habsburgs. They've been a nuisance.
Yeah.
They can get lost.
It's like, I'm done with you.
Exactly. Things didn't end up getting smoothed over, and they ended up making a treaty with the Habsburgs, although they had to give up a bunch of land that had been Margaret's dowry. So, even despite her youth and the fact that she was now at the mercy of the French, Anne of Brittany remained defiant, and she used her friendships with the Habsburgs and the Spanish to preserve independence for her duchy. This is like her main thing that she wants to do. So, while she's now the Queen of France, she also continues to be regarded as a ruler in her own right as the Duchess of Brittany.
Oh, wow.
It's not being subsumed into the crown territories. Famously, Anne, she made her disdain for her new husband very clear by bringing two beds with her to court. This is your bed. This is my bed. To make it very clear.
You can like it or lump it.
Yeah, she and the king would, you know, live separately. And while Charles ended up mostly living at Amboise, the chateau, Anne actually bought a mansion like a few hundred meters away from Amboise. She lived there. It's called Clos Lucet. And it eventually becomes the place where Leonardo da Vinci dies. And there's a museum for Leonardo there. Yeah.
Cool.
But we'll get to that. Nevertheless, she and Charles did do their duty. And Anne quickly gave birth to a healthy baby boy in 1492, which was followed by two more pregnancies in quick succession. So that's a big box checked for Charles. He's got a secure dynasty.
Mm.
So the same year as his marriage to Anne, the young king arranges a reconciliation with the Duke of Orleans. So Charles orders his cousin to be released after 3 years in prison, and he reinstates his titles and his lands. And now that the regency is over, Orleans has no reason to fight with Madame Legrand anymore.
Yes.
If you remember, they had a bit of a rivalry. So
France
is now at peace, both internally and externally, thanks to treaties with the Habsburgs and the new English king, Henry VII. Actually, Henry VII has this little... Similar to what Edward IV did, he kind of does this mini invasion of France. Just goes and, like, stumps his feet a bit there. Down. But the French agreed to not
shoo him away with money.
Yeah, not only shoo him away with money, but they also agreed to stop backing a claimant called Perkin Warbeck, who was supposedly one of the princes in the towers who like escaped.
Yeah.
And the Habsburgs continue supporting him, but the French drop their support and they agree to be fully on Henry's team. Yeah. So, you know, thanks also to the efforts of Louis XI, the kingdom was now a centralized, well-oiled machine. It was very peaceful. Nice. Thanks to Madame Legrand alleviating harsh taxes, the country is starting to prosper again. So what does Charles do?
War. When it's peaceful, let's create a war.
So in 1494, 3 years into his personal rule, he starts another war. The first in a series of wars that will last the next 65 years. So it's now time to get into the Italian Wars.
Yes.
So, as we know, Italy, through the Middle Ages, has been considered a geographic region, but not a country. It hasn't been unified under one government since the Roman Empire. Not even the Carolingians managed to conquer the whole thing. So, instead, we have a smattering of city-states in the north, all of which are considered sort of part of the Holy Roman Empire, but not really. Except for Venice, which at all times is letting everyone know that, you know, Venice, she's not like the other cities. She's different. She does her own thing. She's off on a little island.
She's better than you guys because she has canals.
Exactly. But actual power over this region was a constant tug of war throughout the Middle Ages between the Pope and the Emperor. And the cities exploited this conflict to gain more power and independence. If you combine this with the rich resources, the high population, the geographic centrality of Italy, and the real, like, financial competitiveness of all of these, like, wealthy banking families, you end up with a collection of small but incredibly rich city-states.
Did you ever watch the Medici TV show?
I didn't watch the Medici TV show.
It was good. It had the guys like Robb Stark.
Richard Madden.
Yeah.
I haven't watched the show, but I know everyone's names.
I'm
good for the names. So, yeah, and hopefully TV shows like that will have provided Eliza and the audience with a good reference point for this period. We are right in, like, peak Italian Renaissance right now. It's like everything's happening, and there's going to be a huge cast of characters that we're going to be introduced to in this episode. So hold on to your pants. And all of these little city-states, they range from being monarchies, like, you know, duchies, principalities, margraviates, to merchant republics as well. And some of them are hybrids of the two. Like, Florence is a bit of a hybrid at this point. Because they've got the Medici in charge, but it's still kind of a republic. So further south, we have the Papal States, which you can imagine as a kind of like a belt stretching across the middle of Italy from coast to coast. And everything south of that is the Kingdom of Naples. So Naples is the main reason that Charles VIII is interested in going to war in Italy. So as we've heard many times in this podcast, Naples and by extension Sicily, Naples and Sicily kind of go from being the same kingdom to being different kingdoms so many times that I've lost track at this point, but Naples and Sicily have been under dispute between the royal family of Aragon and the French House of Anjou for pretty much the last 200 years at this point. It's constant back and forth between the great rulers of Europe, whether southern Italy should be ruled by French people or Spanish people. Because, you know, the southern Italians, they couldn't possibly rule themselves. That's crazy talk. They're too busy inventing pizza and pasta.
Good stuff.
Yeah. I'll definitely be putting a map of Italy on our WordPress. Actually, Eliza, I might share a map with you just so you can follow along.
Yeah. You're going to have that stuck in my head.
It shows San Marino in this map, even though I'm pretty sure San Marino is not very important. It's good to know where it is.
And it's its own little thing.
It's its own little thing. but it's not relevant.
Nice simple little map. Yeah.
Nice simple little map. No, nothing chaotic happening here.
Well, it's pretty concise, I can clearly see. Good
little
map.
Yeah, it's not
map.
Too bad. The font is nice and big. So a bit of context for everything that's about to go down.
Yes.
So since 1458, Naples has been ruled by King Ferdinand, or Ferrante in Italian,
yes,
who was actually the illegitimate son of the King of Aragon. But because this king, Alfonso V, had no other children, he decided to just give Naples to Ferrante, while Aragon went to the legitimate line, eventually ending with the more famous Ferdinand, who's currently the king, and the first king of all Spain, because he marries Isabel of Castile.
Yep.
So Naples is essentially a client state of Aragon, and Aragon does actually rule Sicily just on its own. As you can see on the map, like Sicily is brackets Aragon, because Aragon, the king of Aragon personally controls Sicily. But Naples does its own thing, but they're allied because the king of Naples is the cousin of the king of Aragon. So Ferrante definitely needs support from Spain in this period.
Yes.
He is constantly in disputes over land with various popes, disputes over trade routes with Venice, and also raids from the Ottoman Empire. Also, Barbary pirates are becoming an increasing concern as well.
Is anyone he doesn't have a problem with?
And to top it all off, Ferrante had to deal with multiple French invasions from his rival René of Anjou.
Yeah.
Remember, René of Anjou is the son of Yolande of Anjou. He's got various claims to both Aragon and Naples. Yeah, he's trying to get that kingdom. René is very popular in France. He's known as Good King René.
Oh.
But he's not so popular in Italy. And he tries and fails several times to gain control over Naples. And if you add to this the fact that the Hundred Years' War was happening, it's like, you know, it's not a fun time. But he did live past the Hundred Years' War. He lived to a very old age, and he died in 1480. Like, quite shortly before Louis the 11th. But his ambitions were unfulfilled. His male descendants all died out shortly after, and most of their lands, including the crucial territory of Provence, which is very important, all of this fell into the spiderweb of Louis the 11th.
Oh.
Yes.
Yeah.
Who, after all, is René's nephew, because his mother is Marie of Anjou. So as well as being the senior most member of the House of Valois, Louis believed that as René's nephew, he was entitled to a lot of his inheritance. So Louis also uses this as a good excuse for inheriting the claim over Naples. Although Louis doesn't press this claim. Louis was not really interested in Naples. But Charles VIII, upon hearing of the death of King Ferrante in January 1494... and the ascent to the throne of his incompetent son, Alfonso, Charles decides to sort of take his chance. And
May as well.
I mean, he's also sort of keen to prove France's military strength on the international stage. He wants this big grand expedition, this big adventure. He's been cooped up at Amboise his entire life. He wants, you know,
wants some recognition. Yeah, he wants some exploring, some adventuring.
He wants a little respect. Just a little bit. As Aretha Franklin might say. And he also, as well, very important, saw Naples as a stepping stone on the way to a further crusade against the Turks.
Oh, God.
Now, this might sound a bit far-fetched, but the Turks are becoming a major problem, and a lot of Italians are concerned about it. We haven't really discussed the Ottomans on this podcast yet.
Yeah, but they're big players.
Yes.
Or they're becoming big players.
They have become well and truly big
players.
They have? I did skip over one of the biggest moments in European history in this podcast because it
didn't apply to us.
Well, it didn't really apply at the time, and it coincides with the end of the Hundred Years' War in 1453 is when it happens.
And what is this big event?
This big event is the fall of Constantinople.
Istanbul, no Constantinople.
Yeah, so it's now, it's still Constantinople, but it's on its way to becoming Istanbul because the Turks now have it. So Mehmed II, Mehmed the Conqueror, takes the city in 1453.
Yeah.
And with the fall of Constantinople, the largest city in Christian Europe at the time, to this growing Muslim empire, also fell the Eastern Roman Empire, the Byzantine Empire, which has been clinging on for dear life for the last millennium.
Yeah, bloody hell. It's like that, like, decrepit old, like, creature that just won't die.
I mean, it's definitely had its moments. About 100 years before this, the Byzantines were on the up and up again. It looked like they might survive, but then the Ottomans just came through and smashed everything.
That's not happening.
So the last Roman emperor, Constantine the 11th, died in the assault on Constantinople itself. So he went out with a fight. Wow. Yeah.
Oh, wow. Good on him. Like, sucks he died, but good on him for trying.
And listeners can hear loads more about that on Totalis Rankium. They have now covered all of the Roman emperors, including the Byzantine emperors. They finished now.
Nice.
Yeah. So
catch up on all my podcasts.
Yeah. So continuing that history, you know, the Turks, they've been around for a long time, but it's only under the Ottoman dynasty that they've managed to penetrate past Constantinople and then into Europe. And this provoked widespread fear throughout the Christian world. So by the time Charles VIII comes
like,
of age,
next?
Mehmed's son Bayezid II rules over not only modern-day Turkey, but also Greece, and he was expanding further into the Balkans, rubbing up against modern-day Croatia, which at the time was divided between Hungary and Venice. And if you look at the map we've got here, you can see the Ottoman Empire starting to creep in from the east over there. Unsurprisingly, there are constant calls for a new crusade by the Pope against the Turks throughout the 14th and 15th centuries has been going on. But the Hundred Years' War kind of hindered this, and Louis the 11th had been too distrustful of his nobles to leave his kingdom behind for a foreign expedition.
Oh, yeah.
He kind of kept promising the Pope that he'd do it, but putting it off, procrastinating.
Empty.
But now comes along Charles VIII. So
he's like, I'll do it. Let's
bright-eyed, bushy-tailed. And he was keen to bring the fight to the Turks. But rather than just, you know, pulling a Louis the Ninth and just flinging an army across the sea, as crusading kings before him had done, Charles and his advisors decided to think long-term. A long-term solution to this problem. So the hope was that by marching into Italy and taking Naples, Charles could not only gain a foothold of valuable territory very close to the Ottoman Empire, but he could also use this as an opportunity to intervene in various Italian conflicts and hopefully be a sort of a unifying force for the peninsula to rally behind. So Charles believed that it was his destiny to imitate his ancestors, Charlemagne and Charles Martel, by beating back the Muslim hordes, that kind of thing, protecting the Pope, and he would become sort of the new lighthouse of Christendom, the new great Charles. Charles even names his firstborn son Charles Orlando, being an Italian form of the name Roland, the legendary holy warrior of the Song of Roland.
Thing in my head now is Book of Mormon. They're going, Orlando.
Orlando. Well, it's Orland in French. Originally Charles was like, I'm just going to name my son Orland. But then his nobles were like, that's a weird name. So he's like, fine, I'll stick Charles on the start of it.
Charles. We're all going to call him Orland.
So in addition, there were prophecies circling around of a future king
called
Charles. Oh,
I love good prophecy.
Yeah. Who would go to liberate Naples and go on to do the same for Greece and Jerusalem. And while we might scoff at these ideas today, the religious factor was hugely effective in terms of Charles' ability to rally his nobles and his citizens who had so recently been at each other's throats during the Regency and sort of bring them together under a common cause to redirect their aggression outside of France. Charles assembles together an army of between 16 and 20,000 men, according to Robert Nicht, though I've seen estimates reach double that amount. This army consisted of 6,000 to 8,000 gendarmes, or heavily armoured knights, 4,000 to 5,000 regular men-at-arms, and 4,000 to 5,000 Swiss pikemen, the Swiss pikemen are now a staple of the French army. He also brought with him some gnarly cannons, and with this force assembled, after having himself loudly proclaimed as the King of Naples, Sicily, and Jerusalem as well, just for good measure, Charles sets out from Lyon across the Alps, just like Charlemagne, just like Julius Caesar, just like Hannibal. He's crossing the Alps into Italy. So the first place that France enters is the Duchy of Milan. So in the 1490s, the Duchy of Milan is ruled, of course, by the Sforza family.
Yes.
Who were allies of King Louis XI. But to complicate matters, the Duke of Orleans claims to be the rightful Duke of Milan through the claim of his grandmother, Valentina Visconti. Orleans is on the campaign with Charles.
He's like, I'll just go grab it.
There's actually a loyal enclave of Milanese people loyal to the Orleans family. And that's centered around the mountain city of Asti, about halfway between Milan and the French border. If you look on the map, if you look on in the northwest, you'll see there's this little blue blob, like kind of dangling off to the side. That's Asti. That's the little French enclave across the Alps. And that's like the part that's loyal to the Duke of Orleans, believes that the Duke of Orleans is the rightful Duke of Milan.
That tiny little blob.
In addition to this drama between the Orleans and the Sforza family start having their own internal conflict, which is good fun. The great Francesco Sforza, the founder of the dynasty, dies in 1466, leaving the duchy to his firstborn son, Galeazzo Sforza. But Galeazzo dies quite young, 10 years later, and rule over Milan is then contested between his wife, Bona of Savoy, and his brother, Ludovico Sforza.
So did he have children?
He did have children. So Bona is trying to be the regent for those children.
Ludovico
is trying to take over. Bona and her children end up getting imprisoned. Her son ends up conveniently dying in prison.
Of course.
And Ludovico, evil uncle, takes over. And once again, France does have a stake in this conflict because Duchess Bona is Charles VIII's maternal aunt, because she's from Savoy. Yeah. So everyone's related.
When aren't they?
But even when Ludovico defeats Bona, France still has an ally at the Milanese court. So Ludovico's wife, Beatrice d'Este, who is an absolutely incredible woman that I'm mad we can't talk more about, her family were the rulers of Ferrara, and they are French allies. And she encourages Ludovico to make friends with the French, and she, like, entertains the kings and his barons at their court. Beatrice actually ends up striking up a flirtation with one of the French barons, and she even becomes a pen pal with the Duke of Orleans, which is fun. Orleans actually falls ill at this point. He has to stay behind in Asti while the French, the rest of the French army continue without him. So he and Beatrice get kind of close, and this enrages Ludovico, who is not only incredibly jealous as a husband, but also, remember, is supposed to be the arch nemesis of Orleans, who is sitting in Asti and, like, holds a claim to Milan. So there's a bit of drama going on here. But at the end of the day, though things are a bit tense, it makes sense for Milan and France to continue cooperating at this stage. So not only had Louis XI laid a strong foundation of friendship with the Sforzas, but also Milan just happened to be also at war with Naples at this time. So Naples were actually allied with Bona of Savoy. They saw Ludovico as a usurper.
Yeah.
So Naples had been sort of trying to send over troops to
help
help Bona retake Milan, but they'd been unsuccessful. They're a bit far away.
Could we get through all the Naples?
Yeah.
Papal state. Who's the Pope right now again?
Oh, we'll get to that. We'll get to who's the
Pope. Is it the one who I'm thinking it is?
Yeah.
Good, I thought so.
But yeah, for the time being, Charles ignores his Aunt Bona's grievances. He gets along with Ludovico. And because it's the most pragmatic thing for France in the moment, and also Beatrice is working her magic, and she has this habit of sort of charming every man she meets.
Nice.
So the French proceed peacefully through Milan, and the communities that Charles goes through cheer him on. They provide his troops supplies. The Italians are also dazzled by the pomp and splendor of the French army. And, grateful that they're not being burned to a crisp.
That make you pretty happy.
So it's a big PR success for Charles. Nice. But a lot of the rulers of the lands that he passes through, they feel like they're being made a fool of. Yeah. Because they're just having to let this French army go through their lands because Italy is so divided at this point that they can't band together and do anything about it, really.
Yeah.
I should probably mention as well that Genoa, just south, to the south of Milan, has actually been a client state of France since 1396. We didn't really mention when this happened because it happened in the middle of the Regency of Madness. But basically, there's like a French governor in Genoa who keeps the Doge in check.
Nice.
And Charles uses this march through Italy as an opportunity to kind of reassert this authority over Genoa.
Yeah.
So Charles's descent continues southeast, which also brings him into contact with the formidable Countess of Forli, Caterina Sforza.
Yeah.
So originally, Caterina is on the side of Naples, and she's like helping Naples in its war against Milan. But as the French army approach and Naples actually fail to send aid to Caterina, she switches sides and she allows the French to pass through.
She's an interesting lady.
And this caused the troops from Naples who had arrived to scatter and flee back south. She's like, "You're useless, get out of here."
You're too late.
She lets the French go through. So then we get to the Republic of Florence, which now rules most of modern-day Tuscany, thanks to the expansions of Lorenzo de' Medici, often called Lorenzo the Magnificent, I'm sure everyone has heard of. But he has sadly been dead for about a decade at this point.
Yeah.
And Florence has been taken over by his son, Piero the Unfortunate. And as you can imagine, he's on the struggle bus with an epithet like that. You can imagine things aren't about to end well for Piero.
Yeah.
Poor Piero.
Yeah, sure.
So the people of Florence, meanwhile, they were falling under the sway of a fiery preacher named Girolamo Savonarola. Who has a brilliant name. He is a fanatical Dominican friar who was so radically anti-establishment that many consider him to be a proto-Protestant.
Oh.
He mainly preached against the evil vices of the aristocracy and the church, and most alarmingly of all, he made a prophecy that a French king would come to topple the new pope, Alexander VI. And his cabal of corrupt priests, who we will, of course, get to. Or rather, Charles will get to them. So, Piero de' Medici, like so many before him, he was helpless in the face of this French force, especially with the Florentines starting to turn against the Medici.
Yeah.
So, Charles kind of just steamrolls through Tuscany, like a hot knife through butter.
Yeah.
And there's a horrible massacre when he takes the fortress of Fivizzano.
Mm.
Piero then rides out of Florence to meet Charles on his way there, and he basically grovels before him.
Please.
Piero offers up a bunch of fortresses in return for, you know, the French leaving Florence alone. Charles agrees, but when Piero returns to Florence, the people are outraged at his cowardice and his spinelessness. And they completely turn against him. So Savonarola harnesses the public fury. He takes to the streets with an angry mob, and he storms the Medici Palace. So Piero and the entire Medici family at this point flee into the mountains. And Savonarola essentially becomes the dictator of Florence. And now that he's in charge, there's no holding back his religious fanaticism. He strips the exiled nobles' palaces of finery. He burns everything in the piazza in an event called the Bonfire of the Vanities, in which, among other things, masterworks of Botticelli that we will never be able to see are burned. Yeah. He also starts executing loads of young men accused of sodomy, and he basically forces Florence into the most austere, oppressive, violent form of Christianity you can imagine. And he's got this big angry mob of thugs, like, backing him up. So, you might think that all of this would mean the magnificent King Charles would be enemies with the crazy monk. But Savonarola actually welcomed the arrival of the French army because he'd been one of the guys prophesying that Charles would come in and...
So he couldn't really turn against him when he was using that prophecy as a way to get into power.
Exactly. So because it proved his prophecy correct, Savonarola was like, "He's here! Yay!" However, Charles didn't... The feeling...
Wasn't mutual.
The feeling was not mutual. No, Charles...
I hate you.
Charles ended up walking into the city. He marched into the city, occupied the city. And it's a very tense sort of Mexican standoff happening on the streets of Florence. In an altercation with one of Savonarola's commanders, Charles threatened that with just a blow of his trumpets, he could have his men turn on the city and start looting and massacring. Mm. And the commander responded that he would then ring the city bells, calling the people to resist and drive out the French the way they'd driven out the Medici.
Oh.
So there's a big standoff happening.
Who wins?
It appears that Charles was rather spooked by the prospect of Savonarola's rabid mob of Florentines, because he then very swiftly decided to move on and leave the city.
Can't blame him. It just seemed a bit crazed.
So Charles left Savonarola on good terms. Savonarola gave the French king his blessing, and he told him that on the way down to Naples, he ought to purge Rome of its corrupt priests. So Charles is like, yep, all right, I'll do that. He leaves this crazy monk behind.
He's like, hey, get away from you.
It's like when you start talking to someone and then you like slowly start to realize that
they're crazy,
kind of off their rocker, yeah. And you're like just trying to find ways to back out of the conversation. Yeah. That's kind of what it's like with Savonarola. So all of this was, of course, horrible news for Alexander the Sixth.
Yeah. Pope,
who was, of course, born with the name Rodrigo Borgia.
Yeah.
And he is without a doubt the most infamous pope in history for his corruption, greed,
illegitimate children,
and his tendency to murder political rivals who so much as looked at him funny. He was very good at poisoning people.
Oh, he really was.
We sadly do not have time to get too far into the Borgias on this podcast. We are going to do a Patreon episode on Caterina Sforza, so we might see some more Borgia action then. But in this episode, I'll just focus on the relationship between King Charles and Pope Alexander.
Yeah.
Who at this point is shitting himself.
Yeah, can't blame him.
So Rome is at a bit of a low point when Charles rocks up. It's riddled with internal divisions.
Yeah.
It's in no position to defend itself from this enormous French army. And Alexander hadn't expected Charles to get this far in Italy. So this whole time he'd been supporting Naples. His justification is that his predecessor, Pope Innocent, supported Naples.
Yeah.
He also is personal allies with Naples. At this point, he's recently married his youngest son, Geoffrey Borgia, to Sancha of Naples, the king's daughter. And he's also, by the way, from Aragon. So he supports the royal family of Aragon, of which Naples is a part. Because remember, the Borgias are Spanish. Although they're kind of a hybrid at this point, because
they've been there a while.
Pope Alexander has been... Yeah, well, he... Before he became pope, which is like 2 years before this, he'd been a cardinal in Rome for like 30 years. So he's been there for a while. They're very established. And he also has an uncle who was the pope as well. So the Borgias are established, but they're at a low point, you might say. So there's one particularly influential cardinal named Giuliano della Rovere.
Mm-hmm.
He offers his support to France. And his family, the della Rovere family, were not only the ruling family of the Duchy of Urbino, which is in central Italy, but they were also allied to the Colonna family in Rome. The Colonna, if you remember, are one of these Roman mafia families. They controlled Rome's port of Ostia and a number of castles on to the south of Rome on the threshold of Naples.
Yeah.
So they're a valuable ally for France, and they end up all being richly rewarded with lands, titles, and noble French marriages by Charles VIII. But Alexander is a wily customer. Until his eventual assassination some years later, he always gets his way one way or another.
Yeah.
So Alexander, he's surrounded by enemies. He's got this massive French army coming. Tuscany, you know, being just north of Latium, where Rome is. And he's going into panic mode. He's sending letter after letter to King Charles, offering to come, you know, meet up with him on the border in the hope of persuading him to turn around and go home. But Alexander has nothing to bargain with. And Charles is like, oh, don't bother coming to meet me. I'll come to you.
He's like, with my giant army.
No. And so Charles's army just rolls straight into Rome.
Yeah.
So the Pope has no choice but to open the gates, and the two don't get to meet in person until Charles is literally standing right in front of St. Peter's Basilica with all his cannons pointing at it. This, I should probably mention, is old St. Peter's. It's not the current St. Peter's Basilica, which, you know, you'll learn more about that if you listen to Pontifax. To add insult to injury as well, Charles had also captured the Pope's mistress, Giulia Farnese.
Yes, Giulia Farnese.
So she had been, like, on a journey with her mother-in-law. She'd been trying to get back to Rome to the Pope's side, but she was intercepted en route by the French army.
Yeah. Unfortunate for her.
So just in case Charles didn't need enough bargaining chips on his side, he also he's got Giulia. The beloved mistress. So now Charles has no actual intention of getting rid of Alexander and reforming the papacy as Savonarola wants him to do. Doing this would outrage the rest of Christendom, particularly Spain and the Empire, which are allies already of the Borgias. Yeah. But once he got to Rome, Charles certainly used every bit of leverage that he had to threaten Alexander. Yeah, he was threatening to arrange a church council that would look into the validity of Alexander's election as Pope. And maybe start to uncover some corruptions that were happening. So Alexander, very wisely, to just avoid the whole issue, he greets the King of France with open arms, he throws him a big party, he lets his troops parade triumphantly through the streets, he strokes the ego. He celebrates a huge Christmas mass in which Alexander publicly blesses Charles and, crucially, endorses the invasion of Naples. Yeah.
So will that turn Aragon against the Borgias?
Yep, it's definitely a bold move, seeing as the Pope's daughter-in-law is literally the Princess of Naples, and he's supposed to be allies with Isabel and Ferdinand, who are very pro-Naples. But this works. Charles responds in kind. He treats the Pope very warmly, and he swears obedience to the Holy Father at this mass.
Wily fox.
So this was as we said, huge betrayal of Naples. Oh, and also I should also mention that King Alfonso, the current King of Naples, was actually crowned by one of Pope Alexander's Borgia cousins. So not only has he got a marriage alliance with the Borgias, he was crowned by the Borgias. Like, he's very much in the Borgia camp. Speaking of Alexander's sons, because he has at least three of them, if I recall, as well as his daughter Lucrezia, Alexander at this point appoints his son Cardinal Cesare Borgia as the new papal legate for King Charles of France, meaning that Cesare is forced to join with the French army and he's essentially a hostage.
Yeah.
And he's forced to accompany the French as they continue their march south. But Cesare, once the army is far enough away from Rome that it's too late to turn back, Cesare manages to escape the army and just go back to Rome.
Bye.
Getting the hell out of here. Yeah.
I'm not staying around for this.
Alexander also gives the French another valuable hostage, a Turkish prince called Prince Cem.
Oh.
But then as they're going along the road, Cem mysteriously dies.
Oh.
And it's speculated that maybe Cesare might have poisoned him before scarfing.
Fleeing.
Yeah, so France has lost its and they also had to give back Giulia to the Pope as well when they're in Rome. So France has lost its valuable hostages, but you know.
Oh, doesn't matter.
Cesare will pop up again in France at some point. We'll see that happen. So at this point, it's February 1495. The French army has been in Italy since the previous August, so it's been 6 months.
Yes.
And the army is craving action and loot at this point.
Yeah.
There's been a bit of fighting, but not much. So once they actually reach the true enemy in Naples, there's no holding back. Loose. And there's a brutal sacking at Monte San Giovanni. And through these brutal tactics, Charles hoped to teach the rest of the country a lesson about, you know, what happened if they opposed him. And this lesson worked wonders, at least at first.
Yeah.
The other towns of Campania offered no further opposition and opened their gates to the French. And Charles proceeded south at a leisurely pace, breathing in the air of his newly conquered kingdom. And he is said to have entered the city of Naples with a falcon on his wrist.
Oh, nice.
So he was just very leisurely, sort of hunting on the way.
Nice little holiday.
While his troops are burning and massacring villages. So like Piero de' Medici before him, King Alfonso of Naples lost his nerve and fled. He decided to take the vows of a monk and abdicate his throne, leaving his son Ferrante II to deal with the problem.
Of course.
So Ferrante's like, damn it, Dad. What have you done?
I hate you. God.
So Ferrante is actually a healthy young man in his mid-20s who had proven a capable military commander.
That's the right decision.
Yeah, so he was more than ready to you know, step up to the plate to defend Naples. But it was a bit too little too late. Ferrante II realized that he couldn't muster a proper defense in time, seeing the sheer size of the French army. And hearing word of his uncle Federico being defeated in a sea battle off the coast. So he's like, it's not the time. So Ferrante, like his father, decides to also flee. And he goes to exile in Spain. Or I think he just goes down to Sicily, which is controlled by Spain.
Yeah.
So in charge of Naples, he left Gian Giacomo Travulzio, who proceeds to open the gates to Charles.
It's like, hey, come on in.
So Travulzio is actually an exile from Milan, who's like the skilled military commander. And Naples being at war with Milan, they kind of take in him as an exile. But then now that Charles is here, Travulzio gets Charles to hire him as one of his commanders with the promise that when Charles goes back to Milan, Travulzio will be rewarded with getting his lands and titles back. That's the idea. So he opens the gates to Charles for that reason. Having conquered Naples almost, you know, too easily, Charles VIII decides, you know, it's probably time to return home just for now.
Yeah.
He wants to get back to his wife, get back to his sister, his baby son. So he splits his force into two. He leaves half of them with Gilbert de Bourbon, the Count of Montpensier. Gilbert is appointed the Viceroy of Naples, and he's tasked with maintaining French rule there. That's his job. Ooh, so he's got half the army. Got a Gilbert. I think it's Gilbert, but it's fun. More fun to say Gilbert.
Think of Anne of Green Gables.
So leaving Gilbert in charge, Charles then took the rest of his force and returned back north. But he hadn't counted on the drastic political shift that would make getting back through northern Italy way harder than it had been on the way in. So, enraged by the humiliation he had suffered at the French king's hands, Pope Alexander VI proposed to the other city-states of Italy an alliance aimed at punishing the French army for its crimes against its fellow Christians. And the Borgia PR team is really working overtime on this one. They come up with a brilliant name for this new alliance, the Holy League.
Oh, that is a good one.
Yeah.
I like that.
This league was joined by the Gonzaga family of Mantua, the Sforza family of Milan, who had been likewise humiliated by Charles on his way in, as well as the Doge of Venice, who up until now had been neutral. So Charles has achieved his goal of uniting Italy against a common enemy. It's just that the common enemy isn't the Turks, it is him. So at this point, I'm going to do something unprecedented in the history of Battle Royale, Eliza. I'm going to leave this on a cliffhanger. Because this episode was just so chock full of Italian context. So many interesting historical figures running around Charles's story intersects with, that I was like, I couldn't not mention them all. So I couldn't fit the whole biography into one episode. But next episode, in part two, we'll have enough time to both finish Charles's biography and to rate him as well.
And it gives a bit of context to listeners who might not know as much about the Italian.
Yes. So next episode, we will learn of Charles's ultimate fate. So with that said, any parting words, Eliza? What are you thinking so far of Charles?
He just seems like smooth sailing. People just look at it like, I'm just like, they're not looking like scared of him. They're just looking to like see all the people behind them. And they're like, oh shit. Yeah, I'm not going to deal with this.
Yeah.
So it's not like he's particularly fierce himself. It's just they're like, yeah, nah.
Might see that change though. He's got half the men now. And he's trying to get back home. With all of his loot. All of his juicy loot. In the baggage train. See how that goes. But until next week, when we will complete the story of Charles VIII, that is going to be au revoir from me.
And goodbye from me.